This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by the Georgia Radio Reading Service GARS. Hello, I am Melanie Guralnick, and I'll be reading from the May 2025 edition of Vanity Fair magazine. The first article is called The Barren Identity. The world's most famous college freshman is as mysterious a presence at NYU as he is in the American psyche. There is no author given. The night before Donald Trump's second inauguration in January, the 22-year-old conservative activist C.J. Pearson threw a party in the honor of the influencers who had rallied behind the Republican nominee. The following week, he received an email from a journalism student at New York University. She was interested in interviewing him about his social media journey. After some back and forth about her use of the term alt-right, all of which Pearson then posted on X, the political personality made a request. Please, stay away from Barron. There was no need. The student, Julia DiOrio, had never seen the president's son. As of last fall, her most famous classmate among the 30,000 or so other undergraduates around campus, though she'd grown used to inquiries about him from friends and family. Such is the towering presence of Barron Trump, a 19-year-old, 6'7" freshman at NYU's Stern School of Business, in the young MAGA imagination. The podcasters who have dined with Barron at Mar-a-Lago rave about his swagger and romantic eligibility. The president and his aides credit him with strategic mastery as an ambassador to young online men. On social media, where his youth soccer highlights periodically circulate, he is discussed with varying degrees of irony, but nearly always in breathless terms. He does not speak publicly or operate a public social media account, which, by all appearances, has only deepened his mystique. Any view of his true place in the Trump firmament arrives in third-party glances. His mother described him to Fox News as, quote, very vocal in advising his father, and Elon Musk recounted on X how he spent Thanksgiving, quote, discussing consciousness and video games with Barron. DiOrio and her colleagues at Washington Square News, where she is the arts editor, have barely covered Barron's presence on campus. Despite his outsized profile, his campus life has proven too viperous, a notable distinction at a school that counts Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen and a handful of other former child stars as alumni. Even Dylan Sprouse was leader at one of the dorms, DiOrio points out. To get Barron to class, a motorcade of black SUVs drives him about 20 minutes from his home at Trump Tower. Tisch Hall, Stern's undergraduate building, is a block from Washington Square Park and set off behind a barricaded plaza. In the fall, as Barron's first semester got underway, his movements were tracked and recorded on social media for sport. Nah, a junior finance major wrote on Instagram, posting an off-guard photo of him in the back of a lecture hall. Today was wild. The attention started to feed on itself. The conservative YouTube personality Benny Johnson, observing the campus hype, described Barron as a study in what real riz is. NYU, and its business school in particular, lacks a certain social life, with classrooms and living arrangements dispersed throughout Lower Manhattan. Barron's classmates describe his day-to-day comings and goings to me as limited. One remembers asking to play basketball with him. Barron seemed interested, he says, but he got the sense that, with plainclothes Secret Service officers hovering, he wasn't really allowed to do stuff. He's sort of like an oddity on campus, says Kaya Walker, the former president of NYU College Republicans. He goes to class, and then he goes home. In interviews, Trump normally likes to talk about Barron in relation to TikTok, the world of podcasting, and his son's other-of-the-moment interests. When the family was promoting a new cryptocurrency finance platform last year, Barron was touted as the company's leading visionary. But he never showed up to the live-streamed launch event, leaving the host to lament that Barron skipped making his first ever public remarks because we took too long. The pattern is disorienting, but unmistakable. Barron's cachet grows with every missed appearance. He is too young and too wordless to have been tarnished by the broader resentment his father inspires. Owing to some combination of novelty and force of repetition, he has become the Trump child most readily associated with his father's re-election, even as he also skipped the Republican National Convention in July. In a statement, Melania Trump cited prior commitments. A White House spokesperson declined to comment for this story. Barron has long made a blank canvas or a field of battle. Rosie O'Donnell apologized to Melania in 2016 for speculating that he was autistic, and the following year, a Saturday Night Live writer was suspended for predicting on social media that the then 10-year-old will, quote, be this country's first homeschool shooter. On several occasions, Chelsea Clinton has come to his public defense. While the likes of the Bush daughters and Ella Emhoff have also served as inevitable proxies for their parents and step-parents, in the last year or so, the fervor for Barron has taken on an uncommonly dedicated dimension. His schooling has not yet surfaced anything resembling the beer pong photograph from the Obama kids' Sidwell Friends days, to say nothing of the Olsons' reported nightlife exploits during their own NYU tenure. Still, there is no shortage of effort to position him as an emblem of young American indulgence. After TMZ reported in December that Barron's peers knew him as a low-key video game enthusiast, a source quickly emerged to tell people that he was, in fact, a ladies' man. According to the report, young women of all political persuasions were falling for him. The subject, not, it should be said, a strictly dichotomous one, has been widely litigated, with Eric Trump describing his half-brother as the, quote, most eligible bachelor in the world, and one of Barron's classmates confirming to me that, quote, he is definitely a gamer. The Daily Mail proposed that conservative 21-year-old influencer Maria Arana, a Mexican-American NYU student who grew up in Miami, could make for a suitable future Mrs. Barron Trump. I just thought it was very random, Arana tells me, but it's not like I was against it. A junior studying child psychology at NYU's Gallatin School of Individualized Study, Arana has never seen Barron, although she thinks she spotted his motorcade once. She describes the network of influencers on campus as loosely affiliated, with some of them traveling in some of the same circles. Her mainstay for nights out is Socialista, a Cuban-inspired club in Soho. Arana says she's always found the campus environment hospitable to her line of work. In recent months, she also has felt more secure in her politics as she's watched opposition to Trump die down. I've seen a lot of people just kind of keep it more to themselves, she said. It is a prevailing sentiment in the months since the president's re-election. When Trump appeared on the Joe Rogan Experience in October, the host posited that conservatism was the new punk. On the campaign trail, J.D. Vance read Slouching Toward Bethlehem, apparently priming for another end of an era. After Trump won, Matt Gaetz boasted at a New York Young Republican Club gala that the victory was as cultural as it was electoral. NYU is broadly known as a solidly liberal enclave, if not at the level of Columbia, an uptown locus of activism. The plaza in front of the Stern is the go-to student protest site, but only because it is the largest gathering area available on campus. The business school's reputation has more to do with its competitiveness. The, quote, Stern curve is a reliable cliché than it does any political leaning, even if the finance aspect gives it some right-of-center air. In January, NYU suspended about a dozen anti-Israel protesters, leading to the Fox News headline, quote, Elite University attended by Trump's son cracks down on left-wing student agitators. Walker is mildly bothered by the frenzy around Barron, arguing that he deserves a more normal college experience. She recalls a joking remark from one of her professors that he really doesn't belong here. As a general matter, she understands why Baron has been so readily elevated by his peers. But even with a crop of new right-wing culture warriors beginning to emerge, the foremost celebrity in Walker's mind has remained Lana Del Rey. She's not sure that anyone has yet arrived as a mainstream face of the rearrangement she has been feeling at school. Somebody in the hair and makeup trailer, Timothy Chalamet remembered. They would play this podcast, which is how I discovered it. In the midst of his press tour for A Complete Unknown, the actor was explaining to Theo Vaughn, the comedian and podcaster, how he wound up on his increasingly visible show. Vaughn, who has described himself as feeling like, quote, a secretary sometimes for Joe Rogan, is one of the leading personalities in the loose media space, characterized by its free-ranging and lengthy interview style that became a focal point of Trump's campaign last year. In this ecosystem, Barron is often misunderstood as a behind-the-scenes operator as well as an aspirational figure. His coming of age has coincided with the rise of a corner of pop culture into which the president has slotted naturally. He knows you very well, Trump said during his own appearance on This Past Weekend with Theo Vaughn. He said, Dad, he's big. After Vaughn attended the January inauguration, where the president's son received a standing ovation at a rally, he posted a parting wish on X. I want to meet dang Barron. As Barron prepared for the day that his father would assume office once more, he worked with a tailor recommended to him by Justin Waller, a steel entrepreneur and internet personality. Waller is a friend of Andrew Tate's. He tells me that the ultra-notorious influencer encouraged him to join his online fray and had his YouTube channels taken down for promoting one of Tate's businesses. Just recently, Waller says, he, Barron, and Barron's close friend, Bo Luden, a rising 18-year-old conservative voice, were in a canopy area at Mar-a-Lago, talking about everything that's going on here. Through the glass, Waller says, I see Donald and Elon and Donald Jr. walking in, so they're 30 yards away from us while I'm sitting there talking to Barron. Waller became connected to Barron after Ludon reached out last year to tell him that his friend was a fan of his work. Waller, podcaster Patrick Bet-David, and UFC fighter Colby Covington dined with the teenage duo at Mar-a-Lago a few weeks later. We're just trying to help the young men, Waller says. There's a whole generation of young men that need help. A lot of single mother households. They don't have direction. They need somebody to tell them it's okay to be strong. It's okay to be masculine. Not including Barron, though. Waller describes him as the kind of guy that can start a business that can go public, but he can also sit down and drink a beer with the individual that's running his manufacturing facility. Newsweek recently reported that Barron and a friend of his from Palm Beach Prep School, along with the cousin of a Republican congressman from Idaho, were planning to start a luxury real estate firm. One of Barron's partners said that the company had been dissolved shortly after the election to avoid media coverage, but that it would be relaunched in the spring. In the following days, he doubled back and said it wasn't happening at all. No further business ventures have been announced yet. Barron's not due to graduate until 2028, when his father's term will have nearly ended. A couple of weeks after Trump returned to office, as the spring semester was beginning, Barron appeared at NYU in a cream sweater and black Adidas sneakers. Alongside a fresh set of paparazzi photos, the New York Post announced that the big man on campus is back. His reputation was growing in concert with his father's reemergence as the daily center of political and cultural life. When Tate and his brother Tristan recently arrived in Florida from Romania, where they are facing human trafficking charges, which they deny, Andrew boasted to reporters about his proximity. In the aftermath of the Trump assassination attempt in July, he said he had been a confidant to the son. I'm very close with the Trump family, Tate said. I know them well, and I spoke to Barron after the incident. I look forward to, once I'm free, being with Donald Trump in person and reminding him that he's a bulletproof badass. The broad social media constellation to which Tate belongs is best, if overgenerally, known as the manosphere. Cultural diagnoses of Trump's victory have in large part located it around this center of power, and the extent to which the president has drawn from it. Tate has for several years represented an outer limit to the milieu, its most extreme, vile, and popular edge. His return to the U.S. presented a possible fault line for conservative personalities. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said the brothers weren't welcome in the state. UFC CEO Dana White embraced them at a fight in Las Vegas, saying, "Welcome to the States, boys." When Trump was asked in the Oval Office if his administration had lobbied Romania for the Tate's release, he said, "I know nothing about that." One afternoon in February, shortly after a version of this story was published online, AF Post, a fledgling far-right media outlet dedicated to an America First mission, circulated a comment Kaya Walker had made to me alongside a photograph of her at the College Republicans booth at a campus club event. For this audience, the notion that a young woman had described Barron as an oddity on campus set off an instant tirade. A raft of onlookers derided Walker as insufficiently respectful of the president's son, posting images of her face to convey their incredulity and rage at the author of this perceived slight. It hadn't occurred to me, or Walker, that her remarks could be understood as critical. The sentiment she had expressed was sympathetic to Barron and his place at the center of a campus frenzy, albeit in a distant and perhaps perfunctory way. If anything, the quotation in question was banal. By the next day, the post had been viewed nearly 10 million times. The backlash against Walker was beginning to mount. Before the day was over, she resigned as president of the NYU chapter of College Republicans of America, citing pressure from the national organization. The group said in a statement that Walker's comments did not align with the values and principles upheld by our organization. Its president, Will Donahue, told the New York Post that chapter leaders are expected to request board approval before speaking to left-wing journalists. As the scuffle blossomed into international news, I was flummoxed and intrigued. It's rare and lucky to have a piece of reporting travel so widely, but the campus scandal quickly detached itself from the story in which it originated. I had become an observer, and from the outside, I felt as if I was watching matter change state. In the online slipstream that Walker's comments entered, it wasn't just that the remarks were taken out of context. It was that there was no longer any idea of context to begin with. In her resignation letter, Walker wrote that her comment had been ridiculously misconstrued and that she was merely describing the ugly side of our culture, that delights in forming parasocial relationships with celebrities. She ended by apologizing to everyone that I love and respect that was caught in crosshairs of this willful and malicious reading of my comment. Walker soon expressed regret over stepping down, telling the Post that everybody knows that it's an uphill battle being a Republican at NYU. She said she had put my everything into building up my chapter. College Republicans of America had by then moved on. In its statement, it extended an invitation to Barron to join them as, the authors wrote, the future of the conservative movement. There is an artistic graphic of Barron Trump. It is a black and white photo. It's actually a cutout of his head and two thumbs up. He is wearing a Make America Great Again cap that's red, and there are purple and green and blue buildings behind him. There is no photo credit given. There is also a real picture of Barron Trump at his father's second inauguration. He is wearing a black suit, white shirt, and a teal satin tie. He is standing up as people are seated all around him and watching him, and he has his right arm held up in a fist. There is no photo credit given. That was The Barren Identity. The world's most famous college freshman is as mysterious a presence at NYU as he is in the American psyche. The next story is called In Good Company. As the Juilliard School kicks off its plan to go tuition-free, Vanity Fair gathered some August alumni to talk about Memories and Dreams by Chris Murphy. For Christine Baranski, the most evocative space at the Juilliard School isn't a black box theater or a rehearsal room where she cut her teeth as an actor. "I get really emotional when I set foot in the elevator," she says with a sigh. She remembers its new car smell when she wrote it in the early 1970s as part of the third class to ever study in the drama school. And she remembers, just as viscerally, the people she wrote in it with. "I was in the elevator once with Leonard Bernstein, with Martha Graham, George Balanchine," she says. "I was in the elevator once with Maria Callas." If you know anything about Juilliard, it's probably that it is where some of our greatest artists learn to be great. The school, established in 1905 as the Institute of Musical Art in Manhattan's Greenwich Village, has long given students world-class training in their chosen discipline: dance, drama, or music. Last September, the drama department's MFA program went tuition-free, as the Yale School of Drama had a few years before. Now, and this is why we gathered some celebrated alumni for a portrait backstage at the school's Peter J. Sharp Theater, Juilliard has announced that it intends to go entirely tuition-free for every student. The great work has already begun. Starting this fall, 40% of Juilliard students will attend the institution at no cost. Reaching the school's ultimate goal will take serious fundraising, but other elite educational institutions are increasingly thinking along the same lines. Harvard College, for instance, announced that it will be tuition-free for families with incomes under $200,000. Since he became Juilliard's president in 2018, Damian Wotzel, a former principal dancer with the New York City Ballet, has worked to make the school accessible to all students, not only increasing financial aid, but also designating several programs tuition-free already. Juilliard currently costs north of $50,000, not including room and board, and more than 95% of the students already receive some support from the school. The overall goal is to move steadily more tuition-free to that ultimate place and make sure that talent is the opportunity, not the ability to pay for it, Wotzel says. That opportunity is hard to come by. Juilliard's drama division typically accepts 18 students a year, 8 to 10 undergraduate students, and 8 to 10 graduate students, making it one of the most competitive and sought-after drama programs in the world. Even Baranski had a tough time getting in. "They put me on a waiting list in the spring," she says. It wasn't because she showed a lack of promise. "They thought that the space between my teeth might have been causing a sibilant S," she says. "Over the summer, I had dental work." After capping her teeth and taking speech therapy classes, Baranski re-auditioned for the speech teacher and the drama division's artistic director, Oscar winner John Houseman. "I did a paragraph that was filled with nothing but S-words," she recalls. It must have done the trick, because the moment the speech teacher signed off, Houseman accepted her on the spot. To this day, Baranski says, "It's one of the most moving moments of my life." Jessica Chastain calls Juilliard her home away from home. The Northern California native studied at the school in the early aughts, immersing herself in roles like Arkadina in The Seagull and honing the craft that would eventually win her an Oscar. When you're training, you have no idea what little seeds you're planting and growing inside of you, how it's going to develop into your career, Chastain says. The first from her family to attend college, she struggled to afford tuition, particularly on top of the hair-raising cost of living in New York City. "I was so stressed out about money," she says. She worked part-time in the library and the student affairs office on her lunch breaks and took out loans, a lot of them, to get by. "I couldn't even afford to go to a restaurant. So it was all the cafeteria, she says. Asked how the food was, she winces. I mean, it's a cafeteria, she quips. After Chastain received the Robin Williams Scholarship, which covered the last 2 years of her four-year degree, she could breathe more freely. Having that cushion was like, okay, I can finish, she says. I can get my degree. I'll still be in debt, but I won't be consumed and overwhelmed by it. Danielle Brooks had to pay full tuition when she left South Carolina for Juilliard. I did not have the scholarship money, she says. My parents had to refinance our home for me to come here. Even that wasn't enough. Unfortunately, my godmother had passed away and, to my surprise, left me $20,000 in her will. That was what helped me start my first semester at Juilliard. Brooks made it through the program, starring in productions like A Raisin in the Sun and Claiborne Park, while working multiple front desk jobs at the school, which she stuck with after graduation. I remember nights of crying right after I graduated, she says. Not having the money and working all these odd jobs, trying to pay for college. Brooks is now a Tony and Oscar-nominated actor for the stage and screen versions of The Color Purple. My cheeks hurt from the joy of surviving this place, she says. John Batiste talks in terms of survival, too. He moved to Manhattan from New Orleans to study music at Juilliard in 2004. He was 17 years old. Musically, he felt very prepared, but describes the transition to living in the city as very much a learning curve. He remembers surviving New York City, surviving the limitless options that are presented to you as an artist that's trying to discover who they are. Now, a new member of Juilliard's Board of Trustees, and the winner of 7 Grammys, he's come to believe that it's the institution's responsibility to provide a space where the students can wholly commit to their chosen passion with as little stress as possible. There's enough in trying to sing the perfect aria or to play in the jazz band, he says. There's so many summits that you have to climb before you can reach the level of greatness that everybody who comes here inevitably wants to reach. There are setbacks along the way, of course. I was unbelievably bad in a production here, says Laura Linney. I was distracted. I knew I was bad. It was brutally painful. So painful, she says, that she decided to walk away from the school altogether. Then an acting teacher took her aside and taught her the most important lesson she'd ever learned at Juilliard. He said, "This is where you're supposed to fail. You'll never learn until you learn how to fail." Now, the 4-time Emmy winner is the vice chair of Juilliard's board. I've never left again. That's all the time for this story, which was In Good Company. As the Juilliard School kicks off its plan to go tuition-free, Vanity Fair gathered some August alumni to talk about memories and dreams by Chris Murphy. That concludes today's readings from Vanity Fair magazine. This has been Melanie Goralnik for the Georgia Radio Reading Service. Thank you for listening to GARS.